You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
This podcast episode is the recording of our October monthly roundup webinar. We do go over a few deals in detail on this. If you want to download the spreadsheets, check the podcast notes on your app or head over to denverinvestmentrealestate.com/podcast12. All right, here's the show.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chris Lopez. I'm a realtor at Your Castle Real Estate. And I've got with me Charles Roberts, who's also a realtor, but also the president of Your Castle Real Estate. And this is our October roundup webinar. And best way to think about this is our let's get together and have a virtual cup of coffee and talk real estate. So we're going to talk about a few deals that have happened in around Denver in October. And as always, we love it when people come on the live webinars and ask questions, interact with us. We do them at the, towards the end of every single month. But I know it's hard to always make live webinars due to, you know, busy schedules. If you can't make it live, check out the recording at our website or get into our podcast channel. That way you can listen to the audio and listen to it on the go while you're driving, walking the dog, doing the dishes, whatever around the house. And we actually have a special guest today. So Justin Cooper is our expert guest today, and he's a senior loan officer over at Pine Financial Group, which is the premier hard money lender in Denver. So Justin, glad you're having the webinar. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, guys. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here with you guys.
So we're going to dive into a couple of deals for this webinar, and we're actually going to review the first deal will be a case study of a property, an investment property, buy and hold, that we helped the client get off the MLS in the last couple of weeks. We're going to run through the numbers, talk about it, and then we're going to go through and actually compare it to a wholesale deal that came out a couple of weeks ago and just talk about, kind of compare the numbers, talk about acquisition, just do our best to give an apples-to-apples comparison, because a lot of people always want to know, hey, how do they compare and what are the two are like? So, Charles, you were on the ground with this property, so jump into the details if you could.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a property that actually we currently have under contract, and if you've been to a previous podcast, this may look somewhat familiar, but it's actually a different property in the same complex. So this is something that we got on the MLS. So I'm showing you the MLS sheet. I'll walk through the numbers, and what we like to do is just show you, you know, not what we can do, not what we did 23 years ago in some other city, but like this property is currently under contract. We're closing on November 3rd. This is what you can do in this market. And this is the second one, similar property that we're buying in this complex. So they were asking 171 for it. We negotiated. We came in at 165. I believe we're at 167.5 is what we came in to it. It's a three-bedroom, one-bath, 1,083 square feet. This is a, you know, B-minus complex, nothing fancy. It is on the west side of town. We tend to do more on the east side in the Aurora South area. The west side tends to outprice us, but this is a, you know, a decent community, nothing fancy, but okay units, condos, types of stuff. 1,083 square feet, relatively spacious, three-bedroom, one-bath. If you look down here, let's see, you see, you know, fantastic price, new carpet, new paint. So we have absolutely nothing to do. You know, we'll have this rented by the time we close. It's ready to go, and it's all set. And once again, I think we're in at 167.5. So any questions that you have on pretty much what this property is? You know, that's what it looks like. It's a rental condo.
No, I say let's jump into the spreadsheet to let's see what the numbers say. Okay. And then anyone out there listening, you know, type in questions that you have. We will answer those in real time.
Great. Yeah, and feel free, because we always love answering questions. We want you to get something from this, and, you know, just let us know if you have any questions. So let me go through the spreadsheet that we use. This is Joe Massey's spreadsheet that he put together from Castle & Cook. Once again, you only type in where the yellow is, makes it nice and easy. So we're paying $167.5 for it. My guy's getting a bank from getting a loan from First Bank, from John Wilms at First Bank. Really, you know, simple, easy stuff. I mean, this is just, this is a simple property here. He's not putting any money into it because it's completely ready to go. To be honest, this is actually Let me change this because he's getting a 4%. So he's getting a 7-1 ARM at 4% on a 30-year. I did a 15-year last week with a different client. He did a 15-year and he got 3 7/8. So that's about the difference right now with First Bank between a 15-year and a 30-year. But he's getting 40. And the last one, to be honest, I need to update this. He just rented his other one for $1,650. We came in conservative on $1,600, but in the meantime, he bought one about maybe 3 weeks ago, and he hadn't rented it and closed on it before we got this one under contract. So we now have a comp. $1,650 is what we're getting. If you look here, we use these numbers, vacancy factor 5%. The vacancies in the 1-4 units is more like 1-2, so we'll be a little conservative. Last 40 years, annual rent increase in Metro Denver, about 4%. Annual appreciation, actually, I don't know why I put 4. That should be 6. That's what it has been for condos, so that's our best guess for the future. These are real numbers here. Taxes, $544. Insurance. He is actually managed. He's having it managed by Mark Cunningham at Grace Property Management. So remember that number, 1734. I'm actually going to change this right now so you see what the cap is if you manage it yourself, and then I'll show you what he's going to get. He's a busy guy. He doesn't want to manage it. We have $600 a month, a year for repairs, and that's the HOA. So if you come over to cash flow, you can see why we bought this property. I mean, how often do we hear you can't get cash flow properties in Denver? Well, you can't get 15 caps like you can in Kansas City, but this is an 8-8 cap that he has no work to do in. He already owns one here. He already has it rented. We felt it was a very safe property. He's getting an internal rate of return of 26.7% per year for the first 5 years. Just really, really solid numbers. So as soon as this one came on the market, Jim said, Charles, call the guy. Let's get this. I want a second one. And we did.
And actually, before, go back to that, the internal rate of return for a second, because we had an interesting conversation yesterday, Charles. We were doing a coffee breakfast meeting with a group of investors, and there was a gentleman there talking about who's putting together, I guess, like a multifamily syndication business. And what was his comment about trying to find internal rates of returns for his investors?
Yeah, it was really fun. We actually taught at CB Richard Ellis, which is one of the top commercial companies in town. They had us come in to just talk about what we do. And this guy was great. He was a young guy who has a firm that they're going out and doing projects. So they're collecting money from individual investors, and they have like 105 unit in Kentucky, right?
Not Louisville, but
250,000 people, yeah, whatever, in Kentucky. Yeah, it'll come to us. And they asked, you know, people asked in the audience, he taught, I taught, then he taught. So they asked him, you know, like, are you doing anything in Denver? He said, you know, we'd love to, but it's really, really hard to find what we're looking for, which are great deals with a 20% internal rate of return. And I sort of leaned over to Chris because we were in the back of the class at that point and literally flipped over the charts I had just presented and showed him. The example property we used was at 19.9%, and it was a very conservative one. This one we have under contract 26.7. So you as an agent, you as an investor listening, it's just really important to understand these numbers because you got this professional guy who on the multi-units is saying quite correctly that you can't get a 20% internal rate of return in Denver when, you know, I've got three under contract right now, but not in multi-units. We're buying more condos and townhomes because that's where we're seeing the better cash flow, the better cap rates, the better IRRs.
And the multi-units he's talking about, those are value-add projects that come in, you have to do some work, you have to do better management, do some renovations, and that's how they get the IRR. And we're getting these IRRs with turnkey, ready-to-go properties off the MLS, which we don't have to spend 6 months knocking on doors and pounding the pavement to find. So just another perspective.
Yeah, so we're throwing out a lot of acronyms. You know, it's always interesting because we'll have a continuum of people who are kind of new at this and some people who say, hey, speed up, give me more stuff. But if you have any questions on what we're talking about, please let us know. The bottom line here is this is a property I'm closing on November 3rd. A real simple property. It was on the MLS. Anybody could have gotten this. And the numbers are great. I mean, this is an 8-8 cap for a completely fixed up property. You know, not the greatest complex, but not awful. You know, I've owned worse for 20 years. I'm very comfortable myself. And Jim, who's the buyer, is having Grace Property Management manage it for him, and he'll make lots of money on this.
So if you have any questions on this deal, please type them into the questions box. Now, let's shift gears. So this was our, I'll say, our long-term buy and hold rental off the MLS. And then the wholesale deal I'm going to compare this to is something actually Justin brought to our attention because, you know, Justin's a hard money lender. He sees different stuff, has different perspective on the market. And so this wholesale deal is, you know, it's not like a fix and flip, but it's a sound like it was a turnkey, ready to go buy and hold rental property. So kind of an apples to apples thing. So Justin, I will let you kind of give the rundown on the property and fill everyone in on the deal and, you know, how you saw it and just, you know, there's some interesting stuff to it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks. So this deal actually came to me, interestingly enough, the deal did come directly from the wholesaler originally, but just the nature of what I do and how many wholesale lists I'm on and, you know, I'm trying to help get clients, I'm a hard money lender, so trying to get clients' deals closed, when wholesale deals come through, I've got a file in my email, and I usually just throw all the wholesale deals in there. And then, you know, I take a look at the end of the day or when I have time or later in the week or whatever it whatever it may be. I just don't have time to sit there and analyze every single wholesale deal that comes in because potentially I have several a day. So what I did was I saw the email, I filed it, and then later in the day, somebody I work with, Travis, actually sent an email to myself and Charles because we're both interested in this neighborhood and said, hey, guys, here's the deal. Travis is also very active in that neighborhood, but he's wrapped up in some other projects, and he couldn't take it down himself. So he threw it to us. Charles picks up the phone, calls me almost immediately, and says, hey, you know, I got the last one out there. If you want to run in it, go for it. You know, I'll give you an hour before I pick up the phone or, you know, something like that. And so I did. You know, I dug in. I saw it. Okay, well, this looks good. I started looking at the numbers. Well, that sounds good. And, you know, a quick little chat with Charles while we're on the phone about it and with Travis. And I'm on the phone trying to get this thing locked up. So so I thought I was actually in a good position with it. I talked to the wholesaler. They picked up the phone, which was, of course, great. You know, sometimes you don't deal with folks with the best customer service, but they picked up the phone right away. We had a great conversation about the property and how he got it and what the numbers look like and just kind of recapped everything he had in his email. And then I told him, I'm like, all right, I'm in. It sounds great. I want to do it.
What were the numbers that were presented to you in the wholesale in the email that you got? Like, what were the numbers that you saw?
Well, it's in that First Creek area that I think has come up several times. So it's kind of a known commodity of what was going on out there, right? A lot of townhomes, there was a construction defect lawsuit. So prices were kind of depressed because of that. The lawsuit got settled, and then prices started skyrocketing. So the prices, the same homes, they're, I think all townhomes, were going for, you know, 160, 170, 180, now are 210, 230, 260. And so this one came through with a wholesale price, meaning my purchase price would have been $210,000. So right away, it seemed like it was low. Without knowing anything else about the property, knowing there's only so many types of units in there, $210,000 sounded like it was a good price. So so the buy price for me was $210,000. The property value per the wholesaler, which I always have to take with a grain of salt, but they're saying it was $245,000. And then they figured maybe, you know, you could paint the unit, maybe you could redo some countertops to really maximize that after repair value, if you will. But for the most part, it was in clean, move-in ready, and for a rental, there really was no work needed. So potential as-is value was $245,000, and they were offering it for sale for $210,000.
And Justin, I can actually really confirm that because I have one under contract right now at $232,000 that was built in 2010. The tenant has been there since then, and we are almost certain, literally, they never changed the furnace filter since 2010. I mean, the place is in pretty tough condition, and I have a really, really high tolerance for yuckiness. So we're getting this one for $232,000. My buyer is very happy with it. You know, things are going to be good. But I would say it's the same unit. That other unit, you know, or this unit fixed up nice, $245,000 is really about right, which is why both you and I just immediately, you know, jumped on it or wanted to think about it and wanted to run with it.
Yeah, and so when chatting with some folks, it sounds like rents in the area, maybe on the low end, $1,700, okay. Seem like...
Sorry to keep interrupting, but I literally can tell you that we just got Section 8 approval. We haven't even bought the one that I'm talking about, but they said $1,856, and I'm going to update this because we're going to talk about numbers on one, but I just got the email from my buyer who's been working with whatever her name is at Denver Housing Authority for the exact same unit. So I can tell you the DHA is exactly 1856 right now.
Yeah, and so what I was going to say, I had heard like 1824. So obviously, you know, we know rents are going up in the metro area, and this is the case in point because Travis had rented, again, the same unit, I don't know, 2-3 months ago, I think, very recently at 1824. And now you've got someone that'll be at 1856. So it just shows, one, we know exactly what the prices are, rents, because in this complex, they're all the same unit. There isn't a whole lot of variation. And we have live case studies. We know people who are filling vacancies today. So along those lines, the HOA, there is an HOA out there, $185 a month. So relatively inexpensive, nothing crazy there. As is with wholesalers, you know, relatively quick close. I think it was about 2 weeks to close. And so they gave a quick rundown. I don't think they even told you how many bedrooms or bathrooms in the email. So we got on and just through property records found, you know, bedrooms, bathrooms to confirm the style of the unit. And that was about it. They had a couple comps in there just to reinforce the value that they were saying. And that was it. Pick up the phone, click here for some pictures. Short and sweet from a wholesaler.
Great. Now you actually were wanting to put an offer on the property, right?
Yeah, so I would say I put in a verbal offer. I didn't send an email. I didn't write up any special 17-page DORA contract. I didn't have the wholesaler send me whatever contract they wanted to have signed. I did not get out my checkbook. As with wholesalers, generally they want earnest money. And as soon as you give them that earnest money check, that money goes hard, which means there is no inspection contingency to get out on or other things, right? You give them that check, and that either you close on it and maybe it gets credited to your purchase, or you know, that money is just gone if you back out. So I didn't do any of that.
Do you remember? Go ahead. How much was the earnest money for this deal?
I think it was $5,000.
Okay.
So I didn't do any of that, but I had a really good conversation with the wholesaler. It didn't sound like the phone was ringing off the hook on this thing, so I thought I was in a pretty good position with my verbal offer. Really only contingent upon me getting into that property, right? If there is no inspection contingency, I wanted to at least have eyes on this thing so I was comfortable and I could verify, you know, the status of the unit, you know, from their email. They said, oh, it's great. Maybe you can paint if you want, but it's in good condition. Well, I want to prove that, you know, get me in there and match up. So that's the way I left it. They were going to reach out and find out when we could get into the unit. I was literally in the car, and I was about to get on the highway and say, hey, I can be there right now. But there was a tenant in there, and they didn't think they could get access immediately. So, okay. So I sat back and waited for the phone to ring. And when the phone rang, it was actually a text message, and they said, hey, we can get access, you know, tomorrow, maybe the day after. You know, I'll let you know when we confirm times. Okay, great. And then a couple hours later, I get a phone call saying, hey, Justin, we got another offer. And I have earnest money in hand. We had discussed, and the email went out at a purchase price of $210, and this other person came in at $215, and they have not seen the property, but they know the area, they're comfortable, they're paying $5,000 more than I'm asking, and they've given me the earnest money. I said, oh. So I was a little taken aback, you know. I thought I was in the running, I thought I had this thing locked up, but clearly, I wasn't. And that's just kind of the nature of the beast, I think. In today's market, you know, if somebody doesn't have that earnest money in hand, if you don't have a signed contract, you know, a verbal doesn't necessarily mean anything.
So Justin, let me ask you this question. Like, if this happened again, would you play it any different? Or would you still say, no, I actually, you know, I lost it, but I still want to see it before I'm committing to $5,000. What do you think you'll do next time?
Yeah, so I think from my comfort level, I would have been more aggressive with the conversation on the phone and got more of a commitment from them to not entertain any other offers or to make sure I got the first right of refusal or something along those lines. We kept that conversation relatively informal, so that would probably be the thing. I don't know if I would have gone in sight unseen and dropped the $5,000 in earnest money, but that's probably a more general statement about working with a wholesaler. For this specific neighborhood, I may have gone back and looked at the pictures and called Charles one more time and called Travis one more time. And, you know, I've got another buddy who's got some properties out there and just called him and said, hey, you know, what do we really think? Is this really the killer deal that we think? What do I not know about this place? Because I don't own any properties out there yet. This would have been my first. So where this other investor was comfortable, and maybe, you know, Charles would have been comfortable, or his clients or whoever may have been more comfortable, I don't own anything out there. So I don't have that same level of comfort necessarily, but I'm comfortable with my network, with my friends who do own out there. So I would have relied more on them. I probably would have done that and then gotten back on the phone after those conversations and said, just, okay, you know, if everybody agrees this is a killer deal and yes, we're, you know, Justin, you should be safe, then I probably would have gotten in the car and just dropped off the earnest money sight unseen. But wholesale deals come in all over town in all different kinds of properties, and it's difficult. So generally speaking, I would not give the earnest money sight unseen, but that's my risk tolerance, right? Everybody's on a different journey, and for me, I'm not necessarily willing at this point in my investing career to do that.
Do you think the buyer had a previous relationship with this wholesaler? Do you think that's why? I mean, I know you don't know, but I guess speculate. What do you think?
Yeah, so actually the wholesaler, when he called me back and said he had another offer, told me that he has the buyer has already bought from the wholesaler. So there was an existing relationship, and that buyer already owns properties in this complex. So that buyer's comfort level was already much higher than mine with the property because they already own in the complex and they know the ins and the outs of it all. And they've already bought from this wholesaler. So if I put my wholesaling hat on and say I'm a wholesaler and I have to choose between these two people, one being someone I've never sold a property to, or the other is someone who has performed. They said they would do it. They've given me earnest money, and they performed and bought a property from me. All things being equal, I would go with the person I know can already perform and who has already performed. So, when somebody said, here's the earnest money, I'll give you more than you're asking, and I've already done business with you before, it almost is a no-brainer. Like, I can't get mad about that.
So let's, before we get into kind of comparing the difference in buying the deals, Charles, let's run through the spreadsheet here. I think I got the numbers in there right, but obviously you know the complex a lot more, so I'll have to talk and adjust.
Yeah, I bought three here last year, so I do know this complex pretty well. I've closed on 17 here in the last, I don't know, about 18 months, and I've got another under contract, so I'll hit 18. So, you know, I am the guy who loves this complex. I know a lot about it, and I've made a lot of money here in the last year and a half. It's been great. So here are the numbers. At $215, the rent is actually, I just pulled up the email from Andy, it's $1,868. That's what Section 8 Denver Housing Authority, I know, sorry, Justin, was confirmed. The taxes were $1,156. Insurance, I probably pay like $280 for my insurance, call it $300. Repairs and maintenance, we put in a factor here, and it's $180 HOA. And it's just a great HOA. Very long story short, they had a construction defects lawsuit. They got about $18 million. The HOA got like $11 or $12 million to them after expenses and attorney fees. And the first thing they did is put another $1 million in their HOA. So they have an HOA flush with cash. And they have about $10 million they're spending the next 2 years doing a whole bunch of what we consider really non-structural issues, just a lot of bad roofing done, bad streets being repaired. One of the reasons we like the complex is so much money is going into it, and the HOA has tons of cash. So if you go back over here, what you see from the numbers is this is a 7.9 cap, 13% cash on cash, 23.6% internal rate return. These are not numbers, you know, these are not the best numbers in the world, but for this complex where we feel so comfortable, these are phenomenal numbers. So you saw the previous one in East Florida. We don't know it as well. It's definitely not as nice a community, and it's an 8.8. Wow, that was great. But this 7.9 competes very well with the 8.8 in East Florida because all of the money in the HOA and because it's such a nice community. So it's not only about the numbers. It's also about the community and the level of comfort you have with the community. And this right here is the 8.8 that we saw in the East Florida property.
So go do comparisons. I was trying to do a split screen there, but I screwed up your
So we got 8.8. Yeah, thanks. 8.8. With a 26.7% internal rate of return on the Florida property.
Which is the MLS deal.
Exactly. And then this right here is a 7.9 with a 23. They're really pretty darn close. The moral of the story here is this was an awesome deal. I'm sorry I didn't get it, Justin, but, you know, had I known, I would have said, can you get a picture or two or something to make yourself feel better? I'm not saying I would have risked $5,000 either, you know, but if it was in any kind of reasonable condition and the guy was telling you the truth, yeah, this is one that an investor would want.
Yeah, I mean, I have never bought from this investor before, from this wholesaler before. And there were some pictures that he had sent out, but I was moving quick and I was confident in our conversation. So I didn't dive deeper and I didn't fight as hard as maybe I could have or should have on it because I didn't know I needed to. You know, I thought we had a good conversation. So that was my fault. You know, next time I just need to be more comfortable with how serious I am about what I'm trying to do.
One of the many things to learn here for newer investors is newer investors seem to have the opinion that all the wholesalers want to work with them. There's wholesalers out there, you just have to meet a wholesaler and they'll give you a deal. And the fact is, it's not really true. There's maybe a half a dozen legitimate wholesalers in all of Denver. And these guys and ladies have been generally working for years doing what they do, you know, sharpening their skills and creating their craft. And they have people that they want to work with. So new investors are surprised when they don't get wholesale deals. And the reality is it's because this other guy just got the deal because he's done 7 deals before with John over the last 5 years, and John's going to go with him every time. Not to say, as an investor, you shouldn't try to pursue wholesales. Not to say there aren't exceptions. The world is confusing. But this is actually very normal. The one thing that I was, you know, sort of chuckling with Justin before this is like, dude, didn't you know who you are? I mean, come on. You're Justin from Pine Financial, you know? God, I think that didn't get you what that should have gotten you, you know, because you'd think you would have gotten a little more. But there's a lesson here to understand that when wholesalers have deals, they work with whoever the heck they want to work with.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you see this even if you're working through the MLS, right? Just because you're having a conversation with the listing agent and you think that conversation went well, if you haven't submitted that contract, then there's no reason they can't go with the next person who calls that listing agent but actually sends in the contract. Right, you have to have a certain level of seriousness, and then take action as well.
All right. So before we move on to our next topic, I want to take a short break here because the TV guys Charles and Justin are putting on a great event tomorrow on October 28th, called the Investor Success Summit. So, Justin, I think you're kind of putting it all together. Give everyone the rundown on there and tell us what it's about.
Yeah, so tomorrow, Saturday, October 28th, we are hosting, gosh, I don't even know how many times we've done it. I know we started our first one back in 2011.
Yeah, this is our...
And we've been 15, is that what it is?
Yep.
Yeah, our 15th time doing this. And, of course, the event has evolved over time, but what it's evolved into is just probably the absolute best networking and educational event in Colorado. Now, of course, I might be a little biased because I am organizing it, but it really is. I mean, nobody else brings in 300 local investors. Nobody brings in the quote-unquote power team, if you will, of vendors that will be there. Nobody else brings in as many speakers, and certainly not the local speakers that we have. We don't bring in any outside speakers. Nobody is selling. This is, I think, the first time we'll actually have an out-of-state speaker, but it's not somebody coming in to sell anything. This is so Pine Financial, we do two things. We raise money and we lend money. And so when you're raising money like we are, you have to have the right attorneys. And so what we do is we've been working with the top securities attorney in the country for this. And we have been for years, and we actually got her to agree to come into town and talk. No sales pitches, but she's going to come and talk, and she's helped our business grow to the levels that we're at now. So huge value in Jillian coming into town, as well as the other 9 different speakers we have. At the end of the day, we cap it off with a panel. We try and do something different each time. This time we're doing a panel on raising private money. We figure if we've got the top securities attorney in the country, we may as well take advantage of it. She's got a speaking role where you can come and pick her brain for 50 minutes, and then she'll be on the panel another hour and a half of free legal advice from her. So really is an incredible event. If you haven't registered yet, Chris, looks like you're pulling up the website right here. So go to denverISS.com So that stands for Denver Investor Success Summit, denverISS.com. All of this that I've been telling you is only $19. You really can't get, I mean, anywhere that I know of in the investor community, anywhere in the country, you can't get an event like this for just $19. It's incredible. I'm honored to be a part of it, and I look forward to seeing everybody there and shaking hands and talking to folks. And even if you don't like any of the speakers, just the networking alone is incredible. So I really hope everybody can come out tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And for those of you who are catching this recording in the future, you guys put this on twice a year, usually in, what, May and October, spring and fall time. Is that a safe assumption? So if you're listening to this, keep your eyeballs out on any of our email lists. We'll keep you up to date. Or always just go to denverISS.com. When the next one's planned, that website will be updated because it's a great event that they'll keep doing for hopefully many, many years to come. Just about to change gears here. So what happens when two guys try to share the same computer? We're going to fight over it here in a second. So, you know, a couple months ago, I know some of you have been following us, some of you are brand new to the webinar. I've been kind of on a mission the last year and a half to really put together my own real estate investing strategy and start building my portfolio. And so I decided to put out my own investing strategy for not just real estate, but also the big picture of just, you know, personal finance and also a big believer in the stock market. So I started asking other professionals and investors around Denver who have a lot more experience and a lot more success than I have at the moment. And Justin was gracious enough, either 1 or 2 weeks ago, he sent it over, we got posts on the website. So I've got some questions for Justin here, so I'm going to start running through them in a couple minutes. And if anyone wants to check out Justin's strategy along with the other ones, go to denverinvestmentrealestate.com and then click on the education tab, and you'll see the drop-down menu says investing strategies. So if you go there, all of them will be in chronological order. And just click on it, read it, and, you know, leave comments, ask questions. And if anyone out there is ever, you know, willing enough to share your own strategy, please do. I don't care if you're a newbie or an experienced person. I'm a big believer in that the more you write down your strategy, the more likely it's to come to fruition. And also, if you share it, hey, you're going to get feedback and questions from other investors, probably with more experience than yourself, and it'll help you get your strategy ironed out more. So, Justin, I know this is a really hard thing to do, but are you able to give a quick recap of just your general investing strategy? Because, and if you guys have not read it, take the time to. It's a very interesting evolution of where he was about 15 years ago to where he is now. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and so that's, you know, to be honest, when I was getting ready for this, Charles and Joe and Chris had all put theirs out there, so I printed them all off, and I'm trying to read it, and I'm trying to think about, well, what is my strategy, and I'm seeing what everybody else was writing and how they were writing it, and I was probably sitting on my couch at like 10 o'clock, and I just started scrambling and writing some notes on the back of the things I had printed off, and I started realizing, like, who I am and how I got here and what I'm doing now is not anywhere close to what the original plan was. To me, I wanted to talk more about like the evolution, because I know there's a lot of newer folks on here that come through the website and will be reading this. So I wanted to point out that just because you come up with one plan today doesn't mean that's going to be your plan for forever. So I really talked more, I think, as you said, the evolution of my investing strategy. So for me, you know, late night infomercials are what sucked me in. You know, I was working a W-2 job. I was not necessarily burnt out, but really burning the candle at both ends, super long days, and I come home and I'm exhausted, and I turn on the old boob tube there, and, you know, there's Carlton Sheets and all these other folks, right, and their life looked a heck of a lot better than mine. So that's kind of what sucked me in, and I started learning and educating myself, and you know, through all of that education, you know, I'm hearing about having a vision, I'm hearing about the law of attraction, you know, putting, just like you said, you know, when it comes to putting the investment strategy on paper, things seem to happen, right? That's exactly what happened to me. So I'm thinking, where do I want to be? Where do I want to go? And so I started writing all this out, and I love the idea of fix and flips, and I know I'm going to get to a point where I'm not going to want to swing the hammer on a fix and flip anymore. So if you caught what I just said there, I was going to be doing the work on my fix and flips, right? That very quickly changed in my strategy. But eventually I would want to get to the point where I would want to be hands-off, make my money through real estate, and it seemed like the best way to do that would be to be a hard money lender. So I figured if I'm going to be a hard money lender, I need to have a couple $1 million, and it's going to take time to get there. So when do I want to do that? When do I want to get out of the fix and flip game? And so that would probably be, you know, late 50s, early 60s, something like that. Okay, well, if that's my timeline to be a hard money lender and I know how much I should, you know, the dollars I might need, well, let's work backwards, right? Reverse engineer, what do I need to be doing today and every day and each year to get to that point so I can do that? So that's exactly what I did. I just penciled it all out and said, okay, well, if I make 25 grand on a fix and flip, and then, you know, over X number of years, how many deals is that per year, and how many, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I penciled all this out and literally penciled it out. I wrote it on paper, just like what Chris was saying. And then next thing I know, you know, kind of jumping ahead, you can read more about it in the on the website here, but next thing I know, there's an opportunity with Pine Financial. And that opportunity is to be a hard money lender. And something I just love doing is sharing what I've learned and what I know and what I do. So I wanted to be a hard money lender and kind of mentor the clients that I had. Well, when the opportunity with Pine Financial came up, it gave me the opportunity to be a hard money lender. And Pine Financial, as we just discussed about the Investor Success Summit, we do a ton of education, whether it be classes on hard money lending, whether it's teaming up with Charles, we teach some great classes on, you know, investing in rentals and some other stuff. We're putting on this awesome event tomorrow, the Investor Success Summit. There's a lot of opportunities to teach and share what I do. So I really found myself jumping ahead. The thing I thought I wouldn't be doing till I was 60, now I'm doing when I'm 30. So that alone threw this whole vision and strategy off track. Obviously for the better, right? I'm jumping ahead 30 years. But okay, well, I've achieved that goal and that dream, but what else do I want to do? What's the next step? What's going to keep driving me? So it's really just been a process and an evolution, and I kind of detail it more in the article there.
That was an awesome recap, Justin. I actually want to – I've got quite a few questions written down here that I actually want to highlight and also just ask you for my own you know, my own knowledge. And something that I find fascinating is that I've realized as I've really gotten to know people like you, Charles, Joe Massey, and just, you know, people with experience, and you know, you've got a successful successful years of investing in real estate, is that even though you have all this knowledge and you guys are in professions that really have you in the trenches every day, you seem to have very, very simple real estate investing strategies. And frankly, they've all been much simpler than all the stuff, I should say, than most of the stuff I've read on the internet, and, you know, books I've bought, courses I've been to, webinars, and it's really fascinated me. I know somewhere in your strategy, Justin, you talked about as you're buy and hold long-term rentals, that I wrote down here that you essentially look for gross rents minus mortgage payments, and if that hits the spread you want, you look at the deal. Can you elaborate on there and talk about, because to me, that just seems, if you'd asked me a year ago, that's just too simplistic to work. You got to do a lot more rules and 1%, 2% for all this other stuff. Can you dive into that a little bit more?
I don't think I need to. That's exactly what I did. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about, right? So on that property we're talking about over in Green Valley Ranch, what did we say the rents were? $1,868 now?
Yep.
Okay, so $1,868. So, and buy price, let's say it was $215, right? So if I pay $215 and I put, I mean, whatever, we can use the example in here. What would be the monthly mortgage payment?
The monthly mortgage payment for a 30-year at 4.75.
Yeah, so $897 plus a couple for the taxes and insurance. So maybe, I mean, let's just call it $1,000.
HOA.
I'm not seeing it on here. Where is that?
I can do it.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, let's call it $1,100.
Buddy, how much down?
20%.
I would be putting 25 probably just to make sure I get the lowest rate. But
give me 1 second. I'm going to actually just do it while we speak. So 25% down, interest rate of what?
The 4.75, I think, sounds right.
4.75. 30-year term?
Uh-huh.
Taxes how much?
Taxes.
1156 a year.
1156. And insurance about 300. And 180 HOA. So PITI plus HOA is 1142.
Yeah. So 1142. So I take the 1868 minus 1142. That means that there's the gross cash flow of $726 a month. So in the 45 seconds of three of us trying to scramble and find our calculators, we just figured out that I could make $726 a month on this. That sounds pretty good. I'm getting in the car and I'm driving. Like, so that's as simple as it is. I don't worry about the repairs and maintenance and the vacancies and all that other stuff, because in $700 a month, I'll probably be able to survive.
So, you see, this is what's very fascinating to me, is that a lot of times I read books say, okay, now if the property is 20 years old, I'll use a 5% repair cost. If it's between 20 and 40 years, it's 10%. Then anything over 50 years, oh, man, I'm using 15 or 20%. But, and you don't do any of that stuff. So what is your, what's your threshold of, hey, it's above this number or below this number that makes you take a deeper look?
So 500 has been the number for me.
Okay.
Now, that probably should also be evolving as the market changes, right? When I was buying properties with rents of $1,200 a month, $500 was that number. Now, when rents are $1,800 a month, right, when the purchase price is not $125 but $225, which means my monthly payment is higher, you know, maybe that spread should be changing. But at the same time, I am more comfortable as a landlord. I have more reserves to handle the oopses and the unknowns. So generally speaking, I haven't had to revisit that. You know, if it still is in excess of 500, then I'm still getting in the car and looking at this thing and seeing if it's worth it.
So from all the years you've been doing this, that number has obviously held true for you.
Yeah, for the most part. You know, Charles and I, we do teach like a three-hour class about rentals, kind of. It is a high-level overview because it's only 3 hours, but at the same time, in 3 hours, you know, you can cover quite a bit. But, you know, we always talk about where we're at and what's going on with our rentals. And the first couple of years I was buying rentals, I was just getting hammered at turnovers, super expensive turnovers. But then in the past 2 or 3 years, it's been relatively quiet. And maybe I'm hitting my stride as an investor. Maybe I got all the ugly things out of the way. You know, I hit the learning curve a little harder at the beginning and things are getting easier. You know, I don't really know if any of that is true or not, but it's been a little easier these past couple of years. So, you know, if I had saved, like, what are we looking at right now? Repairs and maintenance of $1,119 a year for repairs and maintenance. That was nowhere near it. My first turnover was like $7,000. It was like within 3 months, I had three evictions, three turnovers, and this is every property I was managing at the time was all three properties. So I had the vacancies on all three at the same time. I had repairs on all three. And I think total that year I had close to $25,000 in turnover. So so for me, that repair and maintenance would not have, you know, made a dent. But for me, I'm not as worried about, you know, what number do I have, right? Well, how old is it and what should my number be on that and have like a sliding scale like you were mentioning, because I have a day job, right? And so this cash flow and these investments are just that. They're off to the side. They're investments. I'm not living on the cash flow. I'm not, you know, dependent on paying bills on whether or not this this property goes well this year or this month. So what I do is I just take all the cash flow and I just leave it in the bank. And then when, like right now, I had – one of my properties has an old – or had an old T-lock roof. So I wasn't getting the insurance coverage on it, and I knew I couldn't – even though we had a huge hailstorm just recently, right, and everybody's getting the roof replaced, that wouldn't have been covered by insurance. So I had to pay out of pocket for that. So that's $9,000 between the roof and the gutter. But I've got, you know, over $30,000 sitting in the account because all that cash flow goes into that account and it just kind of hangs out and it builds up. And when I don't have, you know, a roof to replace, then it continues to grow. And then, oh, look, there's another 25% down on the next property. And so that business becomes self-sustaining in that way. You know, I'm not diving into my personal savings for the next investment property.
So this is actually the exact question I've written down next for you is, I'm always curious, like, how people manage their cash reserves, because as I've, you know, just studied real estate in general from, I'll say, the big picture macro point of view, and just, you know, kind of read books and talked to people, it kind of, frankly, it seems to me, as long as you can hold on to the real estate in the long term and, you know, survive the bad times, you're going to come out really great in 30, 40, 50, 60 years. And so that's kind of made me think, okay, well, I want to be very cash heavy. So, hey, I can ride out the bad times. And if I have to tighten the belt a little bit, you know, I don't mind that, but I also don't want to be, you know, over leveraged or up at night, you know, sweating things out. So what rules of thumb, if any, do you have for maintaining your cash reserves to then, you know, do you hit a certain point and take the cash reserves and then reinvest it to like the next property? What's your general strategy there?
Yeah, so just keep all of that cash flow and just leave that one account and just let it grow. So for me, the kind of threshold was I want to make sure I have at least 20 grand, because as a beginning investor, I had some costly turnovers. So that was kind of my number. And once it's there, then everything above that starts being gravy, right? Now I can entertain, you know, that roof wasn't really leaking. I didn't have to replace it, but I've got enough in reserves, maybe I should do it, right? Maybe I shouldn't wait for the tenant to call me and say, hey, my place is flooding because, you know, it's raining outside and there's a huge hole now. So I could be more proactive. So 20, 25 is kind of the minimum I want in there. And that allows for, if there is some vacancies, that allows for turnovers, that allows for the roof or the water heater or the unknown expenses. And then as it continues to grow, then, all right, now I've got enough for a down payment, you know, and we can start looking at that. Do I want to take some money out of personal savings and couple it with this, or is this enough on its own, and how does that look? And, you know, I can just weigh those things. I don't have anything hard and fast necessarily other than that real, like, 20,000 minimum.
Because that, I mean, just 20,000 divided by 1150 from the Screen Valley Ranch we're staring at on the screen right now is about 18 months worth of, you know, just the mortgage payment. So, I mean, you don't follow like a 6 months or 12 months reserve. You just kind of have a $20,000 as like the threshold in your mind. That's based off those few black eyes you got initially.
Yeah, I think I'm just a really conservative investor. I stay up at night thinking about these things. So what will help me not stay up at night? Having more cash in the bank. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
I can understand that now, as I've had a couple rough times over the years in previous businesses, you know, laying awake at 2 a.m. in the morning thinking, oh, crap.
I don't like doing it. I've got two little kids. I've got a 4-year-old and a 14-month-old, and I lose enough sleep because of them. I don't want to add more reasons to lose sleep on top of that. So I already drink too much coffee probably as it is.
So another question I have for you here. So I know there's I just think, especially with your you know, job as a hard money lender, you got some very interesting, like, you know, resources, I'm sure all sorts of points of view. What's kind of your strategy for, do you re-leverage your properties, or you just straight paint them down, go for cash flow? Kind of what's your strategy with those and your big picture plan?
Yeah, I think I'm still relatively a new investor, if you will, or I'm early in my investing career. So I don't have a lot of rental properties. So, you know, if you look at it from a certain way, I'm still in my acquisition phase, if you will, right? I'm still looking to be buying more properties. So how can I leverage into more properties? So, you know, could I, just looking at this property, we just talked about financing, could I only put 20% down? Yeah, but 25% gives me a little bit more spread in case a downturn hits tomorrow or something else comes up, right? So that'll help me sleep a little better at night. So I'm not leveraging as high as I could, but with these properties, I've owned them for a couple of years now, and you know, the prices have just been skyrocketing, right? Like, if any landlord here knows the benefits of holding real estate over the past couple of years. So the way I maximized that was to get HELOCs. So I've got HELOCs on every property I own, which, again, isn't many, but it's enough to free up $350,000 in equity, right? Wow. In HELOCs, yeah, between my primary residence and the rentals. So there's a lot that I can do with that. And I chose to use HELOCs because, you know, it's similar to a credit card, right? If you don't run anything up on the credit card, if you're not buying anything, then you're not paying anything. So instead of doing a cash out refinance to, you know, get my hands on that equity and that cash, because if you do that, then it changes your cash flow, and then maybe I'm not going to hit my 500 or whatever. I just like having the HELOC so that if I need it, if I want a little extra, say, you know, I've got $30,000 in that rental business bank account, and I just spent $9,000 on a roof. Now I'm down to about my $20,000, but another great deal comes up. I can dip into these HELOCs, you know, pull $50,000 off and buy this, you know, rental property or something like that. So I have access to continue the acquisition through those HELOCs, but I'm not paying every day, and my cash flow position doesn't change every day because I didn't do a cash out refinance.
That makes sense. That is really, really interesting. And you're kind of getting the best of both worlds where you're able to use leverage, but you're also being, I say, conservative in the sense where, you know, you can handle some speed bumps along the way.
Yeah, and that's just my choice, right? I mean, it may even be slowing me down a little bit because if I did a cash out, now I have all this money sitting in the bank, and so I want to spend it. So maybe I would be acquiring faster if I had all that money sitting there. I don't know. But, you know, again, I sleep better at night knowing I just have access in case something crazy happens, but I'm not paying on it until I need it.
So something else I wrote down from your article was you made a comment in there about you're not the best property manager and you recently transitioned over to, I guess, hiring a professional property manager.
Yeah, so I started to. So, you know, I've got three doors. Like I said, I don't have a massive portfolio. And I think me not being a good manager, maybe I'm lazy. And maybe I just I have a big heart. Maybe it's both. But, you know, I wasn't doing inspections as often as you should, right? We didn't have any kind of set-in-stone quarterly inspection schedule. You know, when they call me up and say, hey, you know, I'm going to be a week late, you know, I wouldn't say, okay, fine, here's a 3-day notice anyway. You know, I wouldn't do that. You know, those types of things. And I think those were getting, I don't know if they really got me in trouble or if we just had bad tenants. But that was what I was doing when I was first managing my properties. And like I said, I had some pretty big, ugly turnovers, right? 3 evictions all in the same month or two, costly turnovers. Could I have reduced the cost of the turnover if I had been doing more inspections and, you know, regular maintenance or you know, just holding their feet to the fire with the quality of the house that they were living in? Maybe. You know, could I have avoided the evictions all at the same time if I was better in following up and holding them to what they promised to do through the lease, which was pay? Maybe. I don't know. But I felt like somebody could be doing it better than me. And I thought, you know, after having managed them all myself for a couple of years that I was in a position, I knew all the mistakes I had made, so I could then ask the right questions when interviewing a property manager and follow up and check in on all those things and everything else when a manager was managing the property. So I thought I would try it out. And I had one property going vacant, and so I put a manager on that one, and I retained the other two, and I'm managing those because those tenants, they've been in one has been in 2 years, the other one is quickly approaching 2 years, and it's gone relatively easy. You know, I still have the big heart, I still haven't been doing the right inspection schedules, but all in all, those tenants have been treating the property right and treating me right, and I think I've been treating them right. So I don't think I need the extra expense of a property manager to simply collect the check each month.
But once that turns over, I'm saying turn over tomorrow, you most likely get a PM for that door.
Yeah, so if I had bought this new rental property, I would have put a property manager on it. Okay. Yeah, so one of them, the ones I kept and I'm managing myself, when I looked over their application, they lived on the same street as my property, and they had lived in the same house for 10 years. And then once we got them in there, and I mean, they paid, what, 3 days ago? Which doesn't mean they paid on the 24th of the month late. It means they paid like a week early. So it's these guys are great. They take good care of my place. They pay early. And the last place they were in, they stayed for 10 years. And the only reason they moved is because the landlord was selling the house. So I don't see myself turning that one over to property management anytime soon. But any new acquisitions, yes, I would just be putting a property manager on it from the start.
Yeah, so I mean, the reason that stood out to me is I'll say in my 20s, I was running a couple businesses. I was very much like I did every single thing because I think I was too cheap to hire people to do things, and also too much of a control freak, and also just at that time in my life just was not a good manager of people, or not as good as I am now, or as best as I could be. And you know, while I was saving you know some money at the time, I look back now. I reflect on it and said, you know what, I saved money, but I also missed some bigger opportunities because I was too busy doing some, I'll say busy work, you know, some essentially paper shuffling when I could have been utilizing my time elsewhere. And it's really got me realizing I should always, I ask you this, I always feel like I should focus on my strengths. Like I know a lot of times, you know, you hear two trains of thoughts. One is go out there and, oh, work on your weaknesses. And I've learned from my perspective that, you know what, forget that. Like, I need to double down on my strengths because if I'm good at something, that means I'm better at that than X amount of people in the population. I need to double it, triple it, and just focus on that. And the stuff I'm weak on, I'm going to hire out to someone else. And I've been kind of trying to think, okay, how will that reflect into my investing strategy? And I mean, from your experience, you know, with working in the industry and doing those properties, what are your thoughts on focusing on your strength to maximize those opportunities versus trying to improve your weaknesses? Or where's that fine balance?
Yeah, I agree. I think it is a fine balance, right? Because if you're not good at it, maybe it just means you don't have any experience at it, you know? Or maybe you didn't think you wanted to do it, but you try it out and, oh, actually, I enjoy this. Actually, this is pretty easy for me. Actually, I'm really good at managing people. You know, you don't know unless you try. But you certainly have to be cognizant of how long do you try this? You know, what are the thresholds of measurement to know if I should continue or hire it out or what that is? And like you said, double down on what you're good at. So for me, you know, when I was managing these tenants through those turnovers and all that stuff, it wasn't taking a ton of time, you know, where I'm on the phone or I'm visiting the property, but it was taking a lot of brain power, you know. And as I, you know, grow and evolve, I've been putting more and more value on my time. And that brain power is time I'm not dedicating to the other things, you know, that I should be thinking about or working on. So just that, it's not like, you know, I'm saving 4 hours a month on the phone. That hasn't really changed, but it's, you know, staying up a little later at night thinking about this. It's getting off that quick phone call and, well, what should I do and how should I respond to this? What's the next step on that? You know, that's the brain power that I don't need to be spending on that. So for that standpoint, it made sense to be transitioning to a property manager. And to be honest, this may be a total fluke, but when I hired that property manager, the tenant moving out was complaining about a leak, which I sent contractors over there several times, which was a cost, and they never really found or fixed the leak, supposedly, according to the tenant. So I figured there would be vacancies. There would be demolition to find this leak, repair costs, right, and then get it back up and marketing. So I figured at least a month of vacancy plus the repair costs. Not a whole, you know, gut, but had to find this leak. So before they moved out, you know, we discussed a 30-day, you know, window to move out. I had hired and retained the property manager. So they reached out to the tenant and said, okay, we're going to start showing this, you know, and they did a walkthrough. They started showing it. They had a tenant. They had someone willing to move in the day after my tenant left, and they had discussed with this new tenant, hey, there might be some repairs. We'll need to come in and do this. You know, is that acceptable? And they went through all those steps. Turns out the new tenant moved in the day after, paid rent, paid a higher rent. Rent increased by $105 a month. So that right there, they're paying for themselves, right, with this increase in rent. There was no delay. There was no vacancy because they moved in literally the next day. And it turned out whatever this tenant had been complaining about magically disappeared when the tenant disappeared. The new tenant said there is no leak, there is no moisture, the house is dry, and we had the property manager go and inspect a couple times to make sure of that. So I saved myself a full month, at least 1 month of vacancy, plus whatever the turnover was, and potentially even raised rents more than I would have. I don't know. So massive success in that first turnover when I hired him. Made it well worth it in my mind.
Interesting. That's really good to know. So I know we're running up on the hour. Do you have one more question for you, Justin, before we wrap things up? So, you know, knowing what you know now, going back to, I think, when you started looking at real estate, you know, so 2003, 2004, so, you know, 12, 13 years ago, what advice would you give your younger self if you could go back in time and tell yourself something? Like, what advice would you give yourself?
So the very first deal I did, I actually lost money on. And so that really set me back. I spent all this time educating myself and learning, or thought I was, and then I get into my first fix and flip and I lose money. So probably was to be, the advice probably would have been to, you know, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and get back on that horse, you know, sooner than later. Obviously, I've, you know, moved on in my investing career. You know, I took my lumps and I've moved on. But, yeah, don't wait so long. Don't be as hesitant. You know, spend more time, you know, figure out what went wrong, and then fix it, and then just move on and do the next one. So eventually I did all of that. It just took longer. And actually tomorrow at the Success Summit, I'm going to be talking about my topic I'm presenting on is the five surefire ways to lose money on your first flip, because I narrowed it down to five big ways. There's many, many, many more than just five ways, five reasons I lost money. But it took me a long time to recover from that. I was really scared of losing more money. So that probably would have been the biggest thing. You know, okay, you lost money. That sucks. Why? Fix it and move on and do it again.
Very good advice. All right. Well, actually, do you have any last parting words of wisdom or advice you want to share with? We got a lot of, you know, newer investors listening to the webinar and also the recording once we put it up there. Any last bit of advice for people at the beginning or wanting to get into their investing career?
Read all of these articles that all of these folks have put out. There's so much information in these articles, right? Read books. You're taking, you know, when you read a book, you're taking a lifetime of experience and compressing it down to, you know, a $20 investment. You know, read as much as you can, and then take action on what you're reading. You know, whatever it is, go out and implement it, you know, and see if it works and test it and try it and just take action. You know, whether that's simply reading these articles, whether it's reaching out to all of us through the website, whether it's coming to the Success Summit and not being, you know, a wallflower in the back of the room, but coming and introducing yourself to folks. Whatever it is, just start taking action. And then once you take that action, okay, well, what's the next step? And take that step. And then what's the next step? And take that step. And just keep moving forward.
And actually, to pull a quote from your article you wrote here, since you talked about networking there at the event, I like this. I agree with it. You said, "I believe that your network can drive your net worth." So I think that's a great quote to end off. And when you guys do come out, whether it's to the Investor Success Summit tomorrow, which hopefully you can, or to future events, man, just go up there with a smile on your face, shake a hand, talk to people, and get to know everyone. So we do a question that just came in from Robert. It says, where can we find the article? So if you go to denverinvestmentrealestate.com and then click on education, there'll be a drop-down menu, and click on investing strategies. And currently, at the time we're recording this, Justin Cooper's will be at the top, and then Joe Massey's, Charles Roberts, and mine will be below it. And as we add more people in the future, we'll put them out there. All right, so I know one final thing I want to just bring to everyone's attention, whether you're making it to the Investor Success Summit or not, Charles Roberts is teaching a class next Wednesday on November 1st at 5:30 p.m., titled Cash Flow Investing for the Long Term. So Charles, give us just 30-second rundown of what that class is about and where they get more details on it.
Yeah, you can go to yourcastle.org and get the information on it. But basically what we do is we just walk through why you might want to consider buying and owning properties. And both of you guys talked a lot about simplifying things. And what I've found, I've done a lot of real estate investing in my career. The most profitable things I've done have been the simplest things, is buying and holding. Nothing creative. You know, it's hard to understand, but I actually don't really like creative real estate. I find many people get in trouble with creative real estate because they don't know what they're doing. And I have found that for myself, the more creative I got, the less successful I was. So we just basically talk about, if you want to build wealth, here's how you can do it with relatively little risk. Now, there's always risk in real estate, but we talk a lot about the risk and mitigating risk and building wealth over time and looking at the numbers.
Great. And I believe your castle office is moving, so are the training rooms moving too? Because this will be, for anyone who's coming to pass your castle training events, your office actually, we're actually literally moving right now, sitting in like taped up tables and chairs.
Yeah, we're moving down to our locust. Either come to the yourcastle.org site, click on training and events, or just email one of us. We can get you the new address.
Great. All right. Well, everyone, I appreciate you coming out. Justin, thank you so much for taking an hour out of your afternoon. I know you're very busy getting ready for the event tomorrow, so I appreciate that. Charles, thank you too for spending your time with us as well. And everyone, if you want to catch the recording, denverinvestmentrealestate.com/webinars will take you to there. And please join us for next month's roundup webinar and other webinars as well. All right. Thank you, everyone.